All right. Hello, listeners. This is Plastic Pills, and you are on the Pill Pod. Everyone, I've read it. You're bugging me. You want Deleuze content. So today is a very big day for us because we have our first celebrity guest, and I'm sure he will object to that term. But if you ever do any academic work on Deleuze, you will know of him. So joining us from the far side of the Commonwealth is Deleuze scholar and the founder and editor, I believe, of the Deleuze Studies Journal, or more correctly, the Deleuze and Guattari Studies Journal, Ian Buchanan. So what's up, Ian, and how do you feel about being a celebrity guest?
Well, all my dreams have come true, I think. I think the day when Deleuzian and celebrity go together will be a very happy day indeed. I'm looking at you and Envy sitting there in T-shirts as we struggle through our kind of approximation of winter, where the temperatures here today have plunged to a very low 10 degrees.
Yeah, we're up around, what would you say, Chris, around 30, 32?
Yep, it's about 30, yeah, plus 32, yep. It's
pretty warm. I remember being in Calgary once, and it was like April, and it was 10 degrees, and I was absolutely freezing, and everybody was like, oh, let's go outside and have a barbecue, and they're standing around in their shorts, and I was just like, are you off your mind? This is as cold as it ever gets in Australia.
That's early spring weather out in Calgary. Since we mentioned him, helping me out with this interview today is Vitalist Schillingian, and you can object to the term all you wish, but it's Chris, who you may have heard in previous episodes. Somewhat of an expert on Deleuze in his own right. How's it going, Chris?
It's all right. I'm excited to be here, and I'm excited to be talking to Ian.
And me, Plastic Pills, if you know anything about content, you know the tingly feelings I get for Deleuze. So for the sake of this interview, I'm going to play the role of the state a little bit, as academics tend to get a little jargony if left to their own devices. And I will caveat that by saying I'm not a very experienced interviewer, and I have no pretenses. Otherwise, alas, you are stuck with me. So first, Ian, you have a new book coming out. When is that? And do you want to say a few words about it?
So it's going to be called Assemblage Theory and Method. And it's in production now, and it's, I believe, going to be available as an object to own and cherish in September. It's been a long time coming. I can't believe how long it's been that I've been working on this book that kind of I began to realize just didn't want to be written. alternatively, I didn't want to write it, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
but I set myself the task of writing a book that I liked. And it turned out I was fairly fussy about what I liked. And I must have written at least, 150,000 words to end up with a 50,000-word book. So there was a lot of draft material that has accumulated in folders on my laptop that never made the final cut.
And so some of what I know you for, and maybe our listeners do too, is for your practical applications of Deleuzian theory. So Deleuze on the Internet is your work that I'm most familiar with. Is this could you make that divide between the practical application and a more theoretical text? And where would you situate that if you accept the spectrum?
The spectrum is kind of arbitrary, but I think it's useful nonetheless to think about it. I don't find particularly fascinating a lot of the conversations that people have about ontology and so forth. I kind of like happy to accept that things exist and not worry too much about the state of that. And for me, that's the theoretical end of the spectrum. I think it's good and necessary work, but it doesn't get me out of bed in the morning. But I guess I'm at the other end of the spectrum of thinking, well, once we know about these things, what can we do with them, and how will it actually change how we think about the world? How might it shape a politics? How might it help us to do analysis? And that does interest me. And I've been, for a different project that I've moved on to now, I'm writing a kind of overall introduction to cultural theory, which I foolishly promised to do about 10 years ago and have now finally found time to actually do. So I've kind of been reading a lot of Foucault, and I've been reading all his lectures, the whole lecture series. And they're really quite fascinating. But I mean, I think what's really fascinating about Foucault and what clearly was, a kind of point of intersection between their work for Foucault and Deleuze was the fact that, that Foucault really wanted to, on the one hand, do theoretical work, but on the other hand, you know, try to use that theoretical work to understand practical things like imprisonment and you know, psychiatry and the stuff that really fascinates me is the work around governmentality. So in my book, I use very kind of concrete examples as a way of trying to think about Deleuze's work. And I've always said, you know, in every forum, wherever I've spoken, that to me, if I can't use Deleuze to try to understand something kind of practical and real, then I don't really see the point. For me, it's kind of important to try to make that connection. But I also think that both Deleuze and Guattari themselves were kind of like, you know, we're not just doing this for no reason. We're doing it because we want to create something that people can use to make an intervention into the world.
And because you mentioned his name, I often say we're talking about Deleuze when, of course, in this context, it means Deleuze and Guattari. Unfortunately, sometimes he's forgotten. But this book, if I'm not mistaken, that you're writing, it's on Thousand Plateaus, right?
I guess one could say it's mostly about A Thousand Plateaus, but because that is the book that we associate with the word assemblage. Although it's present in Anti-Oedipus too, it just wasn't translated as assemblage in that book. We translated differently. So a lot of people don't think of assemblage as being part of Anti-Oedipus, but it was in fact there. One could also say that it was not marked out in the same way. So you might argue that it wasn't really there as a concept yet, but certainly the word was.
Okay, and because I'm not sure exactly what the familiarity of our listeners will be, but let's say you sit down, you've just ordered Thousand Plateaus from an evil, ever-expanding company off of the internet, and you have this on your desk. And what is someone supposed to do when they open this up and they see titles like, I don't know, The Geology of Morals and Body Without Organs and The Refrain and these odd titles with weird dates next to them? How would you suggest that someone who has no familiarity with this, who opens it up and says, how the hell is this philosophy? How should they proceed?
Yeah, well, I guess they're probably asking the wrong question. You know, whether it's philosophy or not philosophy doesn't seem to me to be a very important question, because again, that's kind of arbitrary as well. Look, when I first read Anti-Oedipus, which I read before I read A Thousand Plateaus, but I read it mostly because, and this was when I was a graduate student, because other graduate students were reading it, and I was fairly sure that it was going to be nonsense because I thought the people who were reading it were idiots. And so I read it mostly so that I could dismiss it and just, you know, justify to myself that they really were idiots reading all this fashionable nonsense. I read it and to my absolute surprise, I was like completely blown away by it. And I think that experience of just being kind of overwhelmed by the sheer quantity of new ideas and provocative sentences and so forth. I mean, I think that in itself is a kind of intellectual thrill that happens really rarely. Like, it's not often that you pick up a book and you think, damn, that was just like a wild ride. I don't really know what it said or what it meant, but it just kind of overwhelms me. And I think you got to go with that. Like, you know, don't try and make sense of it straight away or even think that that's possible. Just go with the wild ride initially and just enjoy that and be full of the ideas that it sparks in you and not worry, you know, have you got it right or got it wrong? You know, that kind of scholarly work comes later. But just to be thrilled with the kind of stimulation of just such a rich amount of ideas. And I think A Thousand Plateaus is much, much richer in a sense than Anti-Oedipus in terms of, you know, if you were kind of thinking about it in terms of like a thrill a minute, the Anti-Oedipus is a bit of a slower ride by comparison. But A Thousand Plateaus is just stunning. Like, you know, once you get into it, I remember reading it and just being like, wow, where is all this stuff coming from? And later on, you know, I kind of you know, started to learn more about the process of writing it. And that in itself is quite interesting. Like, you know, Deleuze and Guattari gave seminars together for 7 years, during which time they produced 1,000 Plateaus. And, you know, all the students would bring texts, and you can see some of these videos on YouTube and so forth now. And it's like a room full of people, it's like 40, 50 students, and they would bring texts and that sort of thing. So, you know, when you step back and think, how on earth did they manage to cover so much ground? Well, the answer is that they didn't do it all by themselves. They did it with the help of their students, and they just simply churned everything into this kind of huge synthetic thing, which is 1,000 Plateaus. So there's a lot of reasons why it's thrilling and confusing and whatever, and it's because it genuinely is a collective production.
That's a good point. And I didn't actually know that it was that assembled in that way. Chris, I want to ask you a question in a second, because I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is not your favorite work by Deleuze, at least. And you tend more towards his, what you call it, the conceptual biographies of different personas, so Bergson, Nietzsche, Spinoza. So as someone who likes those kinds of books, how do you read or pick up or process this book?
Well, I think 1,000 Plateaus is it's not really my favorite book, but it's a brilliant text. Like in the introduction, Deleuze and Guattari are talking about how they're in the habit of using their names, but they're using this text as a we in order for them to, you know, so you don't just read it like a book. You can open up the rhizome or micropolitics and take a look at specific concepts that are being unraveled in the text. But for me, I always like the kind of monographs that Deleuze has written. So the first one that I ever read that blew me away was Expressionism in Philosophy on Spinoza. And here, for me, I was enraptured by Deleuze in this idea of expressivity. And, you know, Manuel Delanda talks a lot about this idea of expressivity. But it was, you know, Deleuze working through an early modern thinker and, you know, working through the concepts of immanence, working through Spinoza's, you know, concept of the conatus, and making it very modern and at the same time giving you such an explicit and informed understanding of the thinker.
And also a little bit of an unfaithful rendition of the thinker, a lot of people might say. He does this also with Hume, Leibniz in the Book of the Fold. And often people who dedicate their staunchy academic career to these thinkers say, well, you're reading him, you're misinterpreting it.
Yeah, they always laugh about the fact that whenever they read a thinker, there's always some kind of backwards buggery going on that's, you know, with a thinker.
Okay, so back to the text at hand, 1,000 Plateaus. As you've probably taught this text for a number of years, Ian, talking about misinterpretation or interpretation, and are they the same thing? But with this book, it's referenced in so many theoretical disciplines from music studies, cultural studies, gender studies, posthumanism. Do you ever think that this is too liberally applied as a text, or do you think that this is exactly what Deleuze and Guattari would have hoped would be done with it?
Yeah, look, this is a question that I get asked a lot for fairly obvious reasons. Look, I wrote a paper a little while ago about the use of Deleuze within human geography, particularly around the use of the concept of the assemblage. And the kind of point I made about that I wanted to make in this particular article was that there was this sort of survey article talking about all the different ways by which assemblage had been used in human geography. And whilst it acknowledged that Deleuze and Guattari had been a source of this concept of the assemblage, it didn't actually refer to their work at all. And so one of the things that I find problematic, and this is something that I try to deal with through the journal as well, is that there does seem to be a need for primary readings. Like a lot of the kind of the growth of the kind of references to Deleuze and Guattari are through secondary readings. It's not actually reading Deleuze and Guattari for themselves, it's reading so-and-so's reading of so-and-so's reading and so forth. So it kind of multiplies not just the misunderstandings, but it also multiplies the trivialities and the trivializations.
So I think
that is really a problem. It leads to really bad scholarship when you're prepared to just accept so-and-so's word. Like, I think it's important to acknowledge other people's ideas and engage with those ideas, but not to simply accept them as a substitute for reading the original text yourself.
As
for the question of whether or not it's interpretation or misinterpretation, I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier that some people are not happy with or find problematic Deleuze's readings of Spinoza or Hume or whatever. But I've never read anybody who says that he got them totally wrong.
Yeah.
Like, was he even reading Spinoza, or had he even, you know, heard of Hume or whatever? And Deleuze himself said that it was important that people always recognize that the offspring of his work was recognizable, that you could see that it really was something from Spinoza or something from Hume or whatever. And so that was important for him. So his interpretations were not just free liberal inventions. They really were a very strong attempt to bring out something new, but in a way that showed a clear recognition of the original text. So I think that's kind of the space that we should be in with Deleuze and Guattari, to say, well, look, we don't have to slavishly reproduce what they did, and we should certainly be trying to find new and interesting things that we can extract from it. But if we're going to do that, that doesn't mean we should just go off and invent something that really owes nothing to their thinking. And that's, I guess, it's a fairly hard space to define exactly. But I think, for example, you know, I'm probably reasonably well known for having a 20-year-long argument with Delander. But at least part of the reasons why I disagree profoundly with what he does is that his starting point, like even with this, the War and the Age of Intelligent Machines book, which in many ways is very interesting. But the thing that always troubled me is that he starts by saying, well, we're not going to talk about desire. And Jane Bennett does more or less the same thing in her work. You think, well, how on earth can you connect what you're doing with Deleuze and Guattari if your starting point is to eliminate their starting point? So to me, that's you know, kind of veering off in a radically different direction, which no longer can claim to owe any kind of point of contact with the origin. So for me, that's what it's about. Like, you know, how are you dealing with the absolutely fundamental aspects of Deleuze and Guattari's work, and what can you do that's new and original with that?
And just to reference this concept of desire, because this is something that we have, or that I have at least, talked about a lot before. Guattari was trained by Lacan, and Capitalism and Desire was the whole point of the first book of this series, Anti-Oedipus. So what would you say is the significance of desire, and why is it inextricable from getting the purpose of these texts?
So I guess that the reason it's inextricable is because it is the founding premise of Anti-Oedipus, that in a sense you could say that the founding premise of Anti-Oedipus is the history of the world can be understood as the kind of configurations of desire that have been produced historically. That you can't understand history if you can't understand how desire plays its part in history, which then begs the question of what is desire. The only sort of significant theoretical difference that Foucault and Deleuze ever had was around the question of desire versus pleasure. They had personal differences which related to Palestine. Deleuze was completely pro-Palestinian, pro-Yasser Arafat, and so forth, whereas Foucault had probably not, it would be unfair to say, Zionist tendencies, but nonetheless he certainly had sympathies for that position that meant he could not be fully pro-Palestinian. So that was, as I understand it, the cause of their major falling out and the reason why they stopped speaking to one another. But nonetheless, going back to the question of desire and pleasure, so if you think about Freud, like the premise of psychoanalysis saying, well, how can we explain why people do what they do? And so Freud's hypothesis is essentially, he starts by thinking it must be because people obtain pleasure from what they do. But then this idea runs into a number of roadblocks fairly quickly, because it becomes quite difficult to explain. If you say to somebody, you know, why do you like being a handyman and renovating bathrooms on the weekend? It sounds idiotic to say I get pleasure out of it and to sort of say, well, somehow that connects to, you know, sexual pleasure in some way. It just sounds odd. And as a way of trying to explain what people do, it doesn't work very well. So eventually what Freud did was to say, well, actually, it's not really the search for pleasure that dominates people's lives, but rather it's a question of trying to find an equilibrium in their lives between pleasure and unpleasure, between the things that really kind of make us feel uncomfortable, attract self-reproach. You know, this is the stuff that Zizek always talks about, you know, when you're the home handyman and you turn the spanner too far and the tap breaks off and you're like, oh, why am I such an idiot? And so forth. So there's a, you know, self-reproach and pleasure all mixed up in the one thing. And so what we want is equilibrium. So in the end, you know, Freud's theory is a theory of this. This is where the idea of the Nirvana principle and the death drive and all these things come out, is a theory of equilibrium. Basically, we just don't want to be too kind of stressed out, too stimulated all the time. So we're not actually searching for pleasure, really. Rather, we're trying to find a balance between too much pleasure, too much unpleasure, and so on. So that's the premise. Like the whole of psychoanalysis comes back to this one kind of basic hypothesis. So when Deleuze and Guattari come along, they say, well, this doesn't really explain things well enough. So we need to rethink that. And so they're kind of interested in what Freud is trying to say, but they don't think he's got it 100% right. Lacan comes along and says, well, really, we can only explain this in terms of and this is an absolute cliche, but it's not completely wrong, that we can only explain this in terms of lack, that what we lack is what motivates us. And so and you can understand that what I lack is peace of mind, therefore I have to do these things in order to attain peace of mind. But it's as Deleuze and Guattari argue, it's a kind of a theory of diminishing returns. Like you can never actually obtain this particular state of mind that you're trying to obtain. So you live your life in a perpetual sense of deficit. And Deleuze and Guattari don't think that's very satisfactory either. So you've got equilibrium on the one hand, deficit on the other hand. Neither of these theories really explain things that well. So then they come along and say, well, how could we do things differently? And at this point, they then turn to Marx and they extract from him the idea of surplus value. Now, this to me has never really been dealt with very much in the secondary literature on Deleuze and Guattari. And I have to admit, I haven't done enough of it. Work on this myself, but I was recently reading David Harvey's two companion volumes to Marx's Capital, volumes 1 and 2, and it suddenly struck me that really that is the key. We actually need to go and look at the theory of surplus value and see what did Deleuze and Guattari extract from that would help us to understand this idea of desire. And so if you think about what is surplus value comes from the idea of investing something and receiving a return that exceeds the original investment. And in fact, Deleuze and Guattari do use the idea of investment of desire. So their word is investissement, which is a kind of the French rendering of the original. So in English, we use the Greek word because of the weird stretchy translation, which translated all the German words into Greek words. So we think of this as cathexis, which is when desire achieves a kind of a response and a realization. We call that cathexis. But in French, that was translated as investissement. But what's interesting is that the investissement means both an investment in the sort of straightforward sense of going to the bank and putting money in the bank and expecting a return, but also, and this is the part that's really crucial, it means a military occupation. So the original German Besetzung also meant occupation. And that is, I think, what's really, really interesting. So what desire does is it occupies. It occupies a space and it expects a kind of a return. And that's what surplus value is. So there's this whole new way, I think, of thinking about how desire works. And this, for me, then connects up to notions of territory and so on and so forth. It comes later. But really to see desire as a kind of military occupation, that it finds these territories, that it occupies it, and it extracts a kind of a return from it. And it's this surplus value idea that is, to me, super interesting and has not been really dealt with enough in how we think about Deleuze and Guattari's idea of desire.
So when we're skirting around this, the question of desire and how to structure it in the first book, not the Thousand Plateaus, but in Anti-Oedipus, they go into this notion of the triadic structure that psychoanalysis brings. So the
triangulation, yeah, the mummy daddy syndrome, right?
So the Oedipal, yeah, the Oedipal triangle of this mummy daddy thing. And they go so far as to call this an instrument of the state, which is this I don't want to say the wrong word, either molar or molecular family.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, the molar family, okay, yeah. The molar family. And this is a version of state. And they also discuss specific philosophers as state philosophers. I'm just going to suggest here that this book, A Thousand Plateaus, is not meant to be a state text. So could you explain a little bit how you see this as an anti-state text, or how they might have seen it as an anti-state text, and how that explains the structure that it has?
Well, yes. I mean, to me, this has never seemed like a particularly interesting way of thinking about this book, because I think it kind of owes its sense and its meaning to its moment, right? Like when it came out in 1980, but it was really produced through the 1970s, when I think people were more consciously anti-state than we are now. And which is why it's super interesting to go back and read these Foucauldian lectures. Like, these lectures were all given in the 1970s, right? The early ones that I've been reading. And so what you hear Foucault talking about is to say, well, look, we can't really understand this idea of the state if we start out from the premise that the state exists. And in a sense, that's exactly what Deleuze and Guattari are saying. Like, we can't sort of start from the idea that the state just simply exists. And then their methods differ slightly, but their principle is the same. So Foucault says, well, we have to look at the various practices and techniques and procedures that kind of give coherence to this idea that we have of the state, but we more or less have to recognize that the state as such does not exist. And this is what's really fascinating about the idea of governmentality. On the other side, Deleuze and Guattari also saying, well, look, the state exists as an idea, but in reality, it exists as all these machines and assemblages and apparatuses and so forth. So there is a huge amount of crossover between Deleuze and Guattari and Foucault in this period of the 70s, right? Like, you know, if you read in the introduction of Discipline and Punish, Foucault explicitly says, I could not have written this book if it was not for Anti-Oedipus. And then likewise, as you're reading in A Thousand Plateaus, they acknowledge a debt to Foucault, particularly around the idea of the sort of apparatus and the machine, but say that they disagree with him on this issue of pleasure versus desire. But nonetheless, there is a huge degree of crossover between their works. And, you know, I haven't really seen anybody talk about this, but, you know, like when you read Deleuze's, people say it's, you know, one of his final pieces, but I doubt that it was, The Society of Control paper. Now, in the Society of Control paper, he says that Foucault himself was already saying, you know, the disciplinary apparatuses had already disappeared, which is true, right? Like, I mean, Foucault says in these lectures, discipline came to an end somewhere in the middle of the 18th century, and this new thing, governmentality, biopolitics, followed afterwards. But then I was just reading this morning, in fact, at the opening of his book, Society Must Be Defended, he says, so what we're going to talk about this year is this new form of power that has come into being since the end of World War II, since the end of Nazism and so forth. And really, that is control society. I mean, that is what Deleuze was talking about, is when he says this new thing called control society came into being, you know, following World War II, and it's precisely what Foucault is talking about as well. And if you read the other book, The Birth of Biopolitics, there's like three or four chapters talking about the birth of neoliberalism. And again, it's really surprising that nobody has really said much about this. Like, when we talk about neoliberalism, we tend to then go turn to David Harvey or somebody like that for an analysis of it. But already here in the early 1970s, Foucault is saying, well, neoliberalism is the extension of the idea of the market to every aspect of daily life. And so I think, you know, when we think about Deleuze and Foucault, we should really look at this intersection. They were really working on a very similar kind of a problem, which is how do we understand this new form of power that arose in the post-World War II era? And the idea of the state no longer seems adequate. And it doesn't seem adequate because we now live in a time when really the state's only function, and Deleuze and Guattari say this, is to provide models of realization for capital. So the state no longer governs, as it were, it doesn't control people, but rather it provides the kind of regulations that capital wants in order to maintain profitability. And Foucault again talks about this in terms of the sort of paradox of freedom, like how much freedom does the market want and how much restriction does it want? And you think, well, the markets always say they want absolute freedom, but that's, you know, completely false. They don't want absolute freedom. They want freedom, like an individual company wants enough freedom to make money, but it doesn't want other people to have freedom to take away their business.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is this kind of contradiction in the heart of the idea of the free market. The free market is not free at all. The free market is free for me to make money, but free from you trying to take my money.
Right.
And that's the new kind of society of control.
We'll just fall into binaries just because it advances the conversation. But interpretation versus misinterpretation, you're saying a good interpretation is always going to trace back to desire as the origin of the project, the philosophical project.
Insofar as they're dealing with Deleuze and Guattari's work, 100%. I don't think you can avoid that. In Deleuze's work that he does, particularly the work prior to Anti-Oedipus, desire plays much less of a part. One might say that he was working his way towards the work on desire and you know, the stuff through the book on Spinoza and so forth. One can easily say, well, a lot of what he wants to say about desire comes through from his reading of Spinoza, but it also then is a departure from Spinoza. Look, I'm fine. I'm fine with people departing from Deleuze and saying, like, I've done this with Deleuze and now I'm going to go and do something different. I think that's, you know, legitimate scholarly work. The problem I have is when people say, well, this is Deleuze, but you look at what they've done and you think, well, manifestly that is not Deleuze. You have taken all kinds of shortcuts and you have overlooked crucial aspects of his work that make his work what it is. So that for me is a problem.
Chris, you've been silent for a while. Do you want to jump in on here on anything?
Ian, just to jump back to desire here for a second. In Labassidère, I'm going to butcher the French language here. In Deleuze used the word to delire, I think. I think he distinguishes desire from delire. And it's Claire Parnet, one of his students, who's asking him the differences between the two. Could you care to elaborate on that? Or?
Yeah, I don't think Claire was a student, right? Like she was sort of a friend and a journalist. Okay. I may be wrong about that. So the distinction between desire and delire, or usually translated as some form of delirium, or it's often left untranslated because there is no corresponding word in English as such, is quite difficult, I think, to follow. But I think what they're saying with the idea of delirium, and this comes through in Anti-Oedipus, where they're talking about Kant in particular, where Kant was quite interested in what he saw as the sort of pure products of the mind, the things that the mind could just create out of nothing. And this would be the source of all creativity. The problem is that, as they see it, Kant dismisses this as a kind of form of madness and as a problem. The difference between the desire and the delirium then is this kind of intersection around the idea of the productions of the mind. And I think this is the other crucial aspect of desire that really needs to be worked through. But I think this is why they turn to the idea of surplus value as a way of trying to theorize this notion of production, that if the mind is a factory, as they say, and it's producing things, then what is the function and the role of those things and how might we think about it? And so the mind produces things which in turn it consumes. And so that really is then the where delirium comes into it, because delirium is the products of the mind, but it is also the way by which we consume those products. And it has to do with then to the degree to which we are able to recognize them as solely the products of our mind or as having some kind of anchor point outside of the mind. And so whenever I teach versions of this at Deleuze camps and so forth, I always say that, like, when somebody is neurotic and they see the vision of let's say, you know, Mother Mary in their room, then they might think, well, how am I seeing this image of Mother Mary? And, you know, is that real and what's going on here? Whereas the full psychotic break is, oh, hi, Mother Mary, how are you doing? You know, so nice of you to visit. Like, there is just no filter anymore that is able to say that this product of my mind is in fact a product of my mind or could have, you know, some other explanation. That it just, that filter completely disappears, and that's pure delirium.
And we're skirting around this a little bit. I think you might have mentioned it, but in the subtitle of this text and the previous one, it's called Capitalism and Schizophrenia. So the critique of the state is not the first move they make. It's sort of the last move. And to get that as the purpose of this text would be to be reading it backwards a little bit. So could you compare this a little bit to the neo-Marxist method of critique that's going on in France at roughly the same time as this, to which the critique of the state is almost the first or the central move that they're trying to make. So how would you compare this critique or elaboration of the machines of capital and that version of surplus value versus the Deleuze and Guattari critiquing psychoanalysis and then kind of answering the Marxist question in a very different way from the neo-Marxists would have?
Yeah, so look, I think Perry Anderson's work on Western Marxism, which he was writing in the 1970s as well. So what he says is that really the essential problem for most Marxism at that time was, first of all, we have to overthrow the state in order to install a Marxist state, but whoops, that didn't work out. And now we can barely conceive of that as being possible. So now Marxism exists in a kind of period of defeat. And, you know, David Harvey says something very similar. He basically says now that insurrection and revolution are literally inconceivable. Like, you can look at all the people that are marching in Black Lives Matter and the various protests and so forth that have been going on in the US, all of which are super important. But the minute they would have become an armed insurrection, the power of the US military to put that down is so phenomenal, it's literally inconceivable. And there is no state or country anywhere in the world that has sufficient power to rise against the, you know, the US military machine, and no organization within any country that actually has sufficient power to rise against the military. The military control the means of death to such an extent that you know, insurrection and revolution has become more or less inconceivable in our time. So if we accept that as being just, you know, a straight out fact of our life, then what does revolution look like now? And it becomes kind of disappointing because you sort of think, well, basically, if I can't revolt against the state, all I can do is either complain about it or try to change it, right? Like, just to go for reform. And Deleuze basically says, both reform and revolution are unsatisfactory. Neither are going to take us anywhere. And so you're like, well, what is there left to actually do? So a lot of the weak readings of Foucault's notion of governmentality, and this has been really dominant, particularly in Australia in cultural studies, has been to say, well, the only thing left to do is to help government develop better policy. And so there's all these people out there doing very, I think, significant and useful research, trying to better understand what it's like to be a prisoner, better understand the welfare needs of people living in certain situations, et cetera, et cetera. The list is absolutely endless. What they're trying to do is to come up with evidence and ideas and facts and so forth that they can present to government to say, you could do your job better if you were to take on board this information. And so they're no longer interested in trying to reform the state, to overthrow the state or whatever. They're sort of in this business now of trying to help the state do a better job of whatever job it's supposed to be doing. I think what both Deleuze and Foucault were asking was, well, you know, why is the state, or as it currently exists, government, why is that the kind of necessary body to look after our lives and to maintain our lives? And that's really what Foucault was saying with the idea of biopolitics. biopolitics arose and grew out of the idea that for the state to do its job, it needed to know a kind of infinite amount of information about people, and that it uses this knowledge in order to better govern us. But Deleuze and Guattari's question was slightly different, which was something like this: how did desire come to be formulated such that we desire the kind of current state of oppression that we have? Which is not to say that if we were to desire differently, we would suddenly overthrow the government, because we know that that's not possible. But rather, if we look back far enough, we have always been complicit with the state of affairs in which we currently exist. And I think that is a really important and powerful kind of critique, not because it's going to be earth-shattering and it's going to lead to a revolution and we're suddenly going to change the world, but rather because I think once you start to look at you know, what's happening, particularly in the US, but certainly in Australia as well, for me, the great book, I don't know if you've read this, but by Dunbar Ortiz's book, The Indigenous History of America, literally fantastic book. I mean, really, I recommend it to everybody. If you haven't read it and you live in a settler colonial country like the US or Canada or Australia, then you really ought to have read it. But what she shows, and it's absolutely incredible, is just the degree to which, you know, racism was at the foundation of these countries. You know, like the whole premise of the country was to steal land and to set up these divides between those who were allowed to have land and those who were not allowed to have land. And for me, like, this is about going back to the foundation of a particular country and a whole body of laws and a whole way of setting up government structures and saying, well, if we were really, really obviously racist at the very outset of the country, surely the only way to address this is to go back to the foundations of our laws and change them and say, you know, we acknowledge that these were racist laws from the outset. And we're going to change them. So in an Australian context, for me, I have always thought this would look something like this. If we were to acknowledge at a government level that Australia is built on stolen land, the only way we could go back, we can't unmake Australia, right? That's the thing with settler colonialism. You can't overturn, you know, what has already happened. But you can address the premise of it. And so the premise of Australia, same in the US, same in Canada, is that the land was simply stolen. But what if we were to go back and say, well, actually, no, we know that we stole it, but we would like to kind of, you know, address that by saying, well, let's say from now on it's going to be shared land. What would that look like? And what would the foundation of laws look like if they were laws whereby we acknowledge the original owners as being our hosts and that we were here as guests? Then how would we behave differently? You know, and you can look at this in terms of, you know, very small scale kind of example. But if, you know, a friend comes to stay at your house, what are the rules of hospitality? How do you expect them to behave? You don't expect them to come in, shoot your family, steal all your belongings, basically push you out the door and occupy 95% of your house and tell you to get lost. And yet that's what we have done. And so I think we can actually say, well, let's, you know, go back to the foundation of our respective countries and reimagine the laws from the ground up and imagine them on a different kind of hypothesis, not one of stolen land, but one of hospitality. And I think that's what Deleuze and Guattari are asking us to do, is to really look at the foundations of things and say, well, how was our desire complicit in that? And clearly in the case of settler colonial countries, there was a straightforwardly rapacious desire for possessions, for land, for wealth that they thought they were entitled to and didn't feel that they owed anything to the people that they stole it from. And it led to centuries of self-delusions of grandeur and so on. So I think, for me, that's what an analysis of desire, if we were to take that into history, would look like.
End of side one. To continue your adventure, turn the tape over and press play. This is Plastic Pills. If you're a little Zoomer, you're not going to know what that means, but for all my 90s kids out there, we've reached the end of the first half of this interview with Ian Buchanan. It was getting very long, but this is only halfway. Continue on the next track to hear the rest of the discussion with Ian, in which we talk about territorializing the refrain, which is a chapter from 1,000 Plateaus, He also brings in some pop culture examples. And the best part, he dunks on Alain Badiou and Slavoj Žižek for not understanding or misrepresenting Deleuze. You know, philosophical drama is always the best drama. It is going to be hot, going to be spicy, so check it out.